So we're here on Daf Chaf Amud Aleph. See if you can find the place. We got up to Midi Dahava. And that's towards the top of the Amud. Let's see. On Chaf Amud Aleph, you count down from the top. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Towards the end of the eighth line. Midi Dahava.
Yeah, got it.
All right, so let me just give a little bit of the background here, what we know. There's something called Trey. And that means two against two. We have two Edom testifying, and then two Edom contradicting the first two Edom. That's called Hakchasha. And the Gemara says that in such a case we have a Suffolk. We don't know whether to believe the first pair of Edom, the second pair of Edom. And the story that we had last time was that there were two Edom signed on a shtar. Let's say the Malv is holding on to the shtar against the Lova. And the shtar is a shtar mekuyam, which means that we validated the signatures on the shtar. Now two Edom come in and testify against the shtar that the shtar is invalid. It's possible because either ketanim hayu, they were ketanim when they signed the shtar, they were psuleidus, or they were anusim, they signed the shtar under duress. And the Gemara says that in this case we have trey. So we have two against two. We really don't know whether the shtar is valid or not. So the validity of the shtar is besiman sheila. We don't know this way, we don't know that way. So the malva claims that the shtar is valid, and he wants to get paid by the lova. The lova claims the shtar is invalid, and he doesn't want to pay. So the Gemara says that it becomes a kind of a ping pong game, a tug of war. It's uki mamona becheskes mari. Who's ever holding on to it, that's where Bezdin is going to leave it. So if the lova hasn't yet paid up, they can't force the lova to pay up because he claims that the shtar is invalid. If the malva, on the other hand, grabbed the money away from the lova, we can't get it out of the hands of the malva because he claims he has a valid shtar. So that's called uki mamona becheskes mari. We leave the mamon in the chazaka who's ever possessing it. And the Gemara now illustrates this with a case of someone by the name of Bar Shatya. Midi Dahavi, it's similar to the case on Nichse de Bar Shatya, the possessions of Bar Shatya. Now the word Shatya is the Aramaic equivalent of Shote. Shote is a person who's not working with, as we would say, a full deck. Sometimes he's very lucid, but other times he's deranged. He's Itim Shote Itim Pikech. So that means that if Bar Shatya entered into a transaction in which he sold his karka, his real estate, then whether or not that sale would be valid would depend upon whether or not at the moment that he entered into this deal, he was lucid at that point, he was a pikeach, or perhaps he was a shote, and therefore the sale, the transaction is not valid because chere shote v'katan la b'nei deyam ninhu. A shota does not have a valid transaction. He's not a bardas. So what was the story of Nichse de Bar Shatya? De Bar Shatya Zabin Nichse. Bar Shatya sold his real estate, his karka. We'll soon see why it's important that we know it's karka. And he wrote a shtar. And the shtar, of course, was given over to the lokeach, to the buyer, as proof of purchase. And now the question becomes whether or not this transaction is valid or not. Was Bar Shatya, at the moment that the transaction was clinched, a pikeach, or was he a shote? So Asu Beitre, two Edom came into Bezdin, V'Amri, and they testified, Kshu Shote Zabin, that at the time that he sold the field or the real estate, he was a shote, and therefore this field is not sold, the transaction is not valid. He also betrayed, but another pair of two Edom contradict the first pair of Yamri, and they claim Kishu Cholim Zabin, that at the time cholim means he was healthy, he was lucid when he sold the field. So we have two against two, and now we have a siman sheila, we have a question on the validity of the shtar. We don't know if the shtar is valid. The lokeach is producing this shtar, and he's claiming that the shtar is valid, and therefore the transaction was done according to those two edim at the time that Bar Shatya was lucid, and the sale is valid. On the other hand, the mocher says, I didn't sell you my land. This shtar is a false shtar, because the situation, the status of Bar Shatya at the time of the sale was that he was a shotan. Here I can prove it to you with two edim. Omer Rav Ashi. So in this case, Rav Ashi says, Uki trei lahadi trei. We put two against two, which means we have a stalemate as far as the evidence is concerned. V'uki mamona b'cheskas Bar Shatya. And therefore, we're going to leave the karka in the possession of Bar Shatya. Meaning, we cannot force Bar Shatya to cough up the land and transfer it over to the hands of the so-called lokeach, because we don't know if Bar Shatya actually was lucid, was a pikeach at the time of the sale. And as long as Bar Shatya is muchzak, and until we know otherwise, we assume that it's his land, the burden of the proof is now on the purchaser, on the lokeach, to establish that indeed this transaction was valid and Bar Shatya was a pikeach at the time. Until he can absolutely prove this, and he has two edim to support it, but he has another two edim against those two edim, then he has no way, he has no wherewithal of getting the karka out of the hands of Bar Shatya.
His word doesn't make a difference.
Well, not really, because it's his word against his word. Being lokeach is saying that the sale is valid. Bar Shatya is, of course, interested in saying that it's not valid. He doesn't want to give up on his real estate. And as far as evidence is concerned, the mocher Bar Shatya brings two edim to invalidate the sale. The lokeach, from his perspective, brings two edim to validate the sale. It's a toss-up, it's a tug-of-war, and therefore we have to leave the karka wherever it is. Bezin can't actively get involved, excuse me, to undermine the muhzakus of Bar Shatya. Oh. Now all this applies to karka. As we said before, the issue here was about karka. If it was a case of metaltolin, then we'd have that ping pong game that we mentioned before, in which it all depends who grabs onto the object. In other words, if it's a movable object, then the lokeach could grab onto the object and say, well, the sale was valid. And now the burden of proof is back onto Bar Shatya to invalidate the sale. But in the case of karka, there's no such thing as a tug of war, because there's no tfis on karka. Karka, wherever it is, we leave it in the muzakus of the markav. In other words, whoever we know was the owner of this field, he remains the owner of the field until proven otherwise. That's called the chazok on karka. It doesn't matter if somebody grabs it. There's no such thing as a tfis of grabbing karka. And therefore, since Bar Shatya in this case is the Marakama, meaning he has Muxokus that it was his karka, then what Bezin has to do is they have to say to the lokeach, buddy, you have no claim to this karka until you can absolutely prove. The only way actually the lokeach could prove that the sale was valid would be if he would somehow disqualify the first two edim.
Also, would it be considered Muxok if we were to build like a house or something on that land, on the karka?
Well, Who's building the house? Meaning, is Bar Shatya,
I mean, either
paying
one,
like workers, so to speak? You know, he contracts a company to, you know, some sort of kablan to build the house. I mean, if the lokeach, see, what happens if I build a house on your karka? I don't know what the din is. I think the din would be that I would be forced to take apart the house and I could get the wood of the house.
But that's not proving any sort of muhzak.
No, because again, the karka and the land, and not only the land, but anything that's attached to the land is one entity. And in this case, we have a muhzak on the land. You can't illegally trespass into his land and build something on the land and say, well, now everything's mine. No, we're not going to allow you to do that.
Wouldn't it be for something that's metatavin, that's smuvil. So whatever object is in the person's hands,
correct, he becomes a muksak. So even though here, in this case we,
it would be as if he's in his hands because he built on that land.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. That's not metatavin. And we have a principle called mechuvah lekarka kikarka dom. So anything that's attached to the land has the status of land. It's not metatavin. Mm-hmm. But what's important to point out here, and I just reiterate what I said before, is that if it was metaltalin, let's say there was a trade, two edim against two edim, as to whether Bar Shatya was lucid at the time that he sold the diamond ring, then if the lokech would go ahead and stealthily sneak into the house of Bar Shatya and grab onto the diamond ring, claiming that he has two edim, that the sale was valid, we wouldn't be able to force this lokeach to cough up the diamond ring, because now he has mukzokas on the ring. And this is the fundamental difference between karka and metaltalin. Karka, the chazok of karka is marakama, whoever owned it before. In metaltalin, chazoka means tfisa, who's ever grabbing onto it now. Now, let me ask you a different question here, and this is as an introduction to the next line in the Gemara. We're assuming that Bar Shatya, with regard to this piece of real estate, this soda, for example, is the muksak, he's the marakama. Well, how did he come to buy this field? How does he come to own the field?
Originally?
Yeah, originally, way back when. You know, we're saying, well, Bar Shatya is the owner of this karka, and therefore anyone who tries to undermine that and prove that he's not, well, the burden of proof. But how did Bar Shatya buy this karka? Maybe he was a shoder at the time that he bought the karka.
And it could have been inherited also.
Oh, that's what the Gemara is going to say, that this karka was inherited. When it comes to inheritance, it's irrelevant whether the heir is lucid or he's a shoder. That's what the Gemara points out now. This is Rav Ashi continuing. He says, V'lo amaron, when does my ruling apply? Only Ela de Isle Chazaka de Avasa. He has a Chazaka from his father's, meaning he can prove that this land was once owned by his father and, or his grandfather, doesn't matter whom, and he inherited it. That gives him what's called the Cheskes Marakam. Avol Esle Chazaka de Avasa. If he doesn't have proof to the effect that this karka was once owned by his ancestors, and therefore he inherited it, then the story changes entirely. Amrina, we're going to say the following, Kishu Shota Zavan, Kishu Shota Zabin. You know, it's the same way that when he sold the field to this buyer, to this purchaser, he was a Shota, right? That's the claim of Bar Shatya, which he has two edim to is. The same thing is going to apply when he originally bought this karka. When he bought the karka, he was also a shota. In other words, basically, we can establish that the karka was never his from the get-go, because the status of Bar Shatya with regard to owning this karka is in question. We don't know. So now the lokeach who purchased the karka from Bar Shatya, he has a right to say that my purchase is valid, correct? And he has two edim to support that. Meaning he has two edim, if you recall, that Bar Shatya was a pikeach at the time that he sold him the field.
But in the case where it's not...
Wait, just give me one more minute, because otherwise I'm going to forget what I'm going to lose my trend here. So let me just, again, I want to just capture, grasp this concept. So if there's no cheskas avasa, we have no way of establishing for sure, for certainty, that the karka was ever owned by Bar Shatya, because we could always ask the question, well, how did Bar Shatya acquire ownership over this karka? Which means maybe when he bought the karka, he was not lucid and the entire sale was invalid. Maybe he was a shota at the time that he bought the karka. So the status, the chazaka of Bar Shatya with regard to this karka is in question. We don't know what was his situation, Maya Matzavo Anafshi, when he bought the karka, we don't know. And not now, what happens is, we have the following scenario. This is what I want to try to understand. On the one hand, Bar Shatya has no clear-cut chazaka. On the other hand, the buyer who purchased the karka from Barshatya, he also likewise has no valid, you know, chazaka, or at least his chazaka is in question. So what do we do in this case? We don't know what to do with the karka. So if you take a look here, he says the following. This is evaluation or reformulation of Rashi. He says the following: Kishem she yitachin she mocher es hakarka lokeach kshaya shota kach yitachin she b'shal she kana es hakarka haya shota v'kein lo hayis hakarka shelo me'olam ela shel oso adam she mocher lo. Now let's go back to the original seller who sold the karka to Bar Shatya. Hare ein oso mechira kayemes. If we have a 50% statistical probability that Bar Shatya was a shota at the time that he purchased the karka, that transaction is invalid. Then on that 50% chance, the karka reverts back to its original owner. He's the true owner. Nimsa shein lahachshivo kimuchsok b'karka mikol kniyoso. The fact that Bar Shatya purchased the piece of property doesn't make him into a muchsok. He has no chazok in the karka, and therefore nechshav hakone menu lemuchsak bo sharei hu yoshev bo. Okay, so now what we're assuming? How are you, Aaron? Shalom aleichem. How are you? What we're assuming is that when a person purchases a piece of karka, a piece of land. Then he enters into that land. Now, we don't know if the sale is valid, but at least he's sitting on the land. So how do we undermine him? How do we get rid of him? And the answer is we can only get rid of him if we have proof positive, if we have clear evidence that his purchase was an invalid purchase. Now, in this case, we have no evidence one way or the other. So basically, what we're going to do is leave the situation status quo, and the one who bought this piece of land is going to be allowed to stay in the land. Meaning, if all things were equal and we knew that at one point the seller owned the land, then he would have a right to say, well, until you prove that I sold the land, status quo is in my favor. But now that the seller himself has questionable ownership and we're not certain at all whether he owned the land, then the one who purchased the land, since he's now in possession, you know, he's squatting in the land, shall we say, he now has the chazaka. What were you going to say before, Sammy?
And it goes the same way for if he couldn't prove his inheritance either. If
then this is the case where he could not prove his inheritance. Again, let's go over.
Or
if the seller, meaning the Bar Shatya, could prove that his inheritance, that establishes him as the muhsan.
Or if he was, how do you call it, shtia?
Bar Shatya, yeah.
Yeah, if it was Bar Shatya during the original when he originally purchased it also. And they
well, again, well, let's ask the following question. Do we have proof that this land belonged to the father of Bar Shatya? If we do, then with the death of his father, he, Bar Shatya, inherits the land. Whether he was working with a full deck, whether he was lucid and he was a bikeah, whether he was a shota, and his transactions are invalid, that's totally irrelevant. Why? Because when you inherit something from your father, you don't have to be a bar das. There's no das in Yerusha. Yerusha is me'elav. It's automatic. So you inherit something automatically. There's no need for any sort of transaction. So once again, let's review. If we have two witnesses to testify that this land belonged to the father of Bar Shatya, and Bar Shatya inherited it from his father, that creates a chazaka on behalf of Bar Shatya vis-a-vis this land. And now, if the purchaser has to, you know, if he wants to come forward with the claim that he bought the land for Bar Shatya, the burden of proof is upon him, Hamotzi Mechel Varaya, because Bar Shatya clearly was once upon the time the owner of the karka. And unless you can validate it with absolute certainty the transaction, then you can't get the karka away from Bar Shatya. But if, in the absence of any testimony to the fact that this karka once belonged to the ancestors of Bar Shatya, we don't know that he inherited it, for all practical purposes we have to assume he purchased the karka, then we don't know if his purchase is valid, which means that basically Barshatya's relationship to this karka is in question. There's no certainty here. Therefore, if he sold the karka and the buyer is now sitting in the karka and possessing it, you know, he lives there, he grabs it, and he plows the land and plants the land and harvests the produce, or he locks it up with a fence, a gate, whatever it is, then we can't undermine his chazok on the karka because Barshatya has no chazok on the karka. Is that clear? Aaron, you came a little late. What is your name, by the way?
My English name is Joel, my Hebrew name is Chaim.
Okay, what do you prefer? I mean, you have any... Either way, you're ambidextrous.
I prefer, yeah.
Okay, so what do you say, Chaim?
Well, whenever I go to a Gemara class, because I didn't have any training in Gemara...
you don't have any training.
I'm always thinking about the modern world. Like, how does it apply currently in the current law? Because I own a little... I made a horrible bad investment.
Okay.
I invested in electric bikes in a fraudulent Chinese company. I lost $500,000.
Wow.
When I was doing well, and I won a court judgment that the lawyers can't collect on. Anyway, maybe that, maybe Bezrat Hashem, they'll collect. The judgment was for four times what I lost. War started 5 years ago. When I was doing my own business, I bought 3 acres of land in Hawaii. I have someone there, a friend of mine, who lives on the land, and, you know, but I own the deeds. I mean, that was a clear transfer. The person owned the land, sold it to me. There was a title company. You know, I put the money in escrow. They sent me the title. You know, I go pay the taxes in Hawaii. How does this apply in the modern, like in those days, there were no computers. You know, they had, it was, I can understand. But now everything is, you know.
Right, everything's registered in the municipality. Right.
Digitally signed.
I always feel like.
Digital what?
Hopefully digitally signed.
Digitally signed. So, Chaim, in your case, again, in a modern context, where you don't need two witnesses to establish your clear cut ownership and possession over the land, because it's registered in the registry, then anyone who claims that the land is his, the burden of proof will be on him to establish that you sold him the land.
Right.
Back in the day when we weren't so sophisticated, we didn't have computers, we didn't have land registry, then the only way you could establish your ownership would be through two witnesses, because the Torah relies on two witnesses.
Interesting.
Now, here's a very complicated case. You came a little late, so I'll just fill you in on one of the pieces of the background here. The particular case that we have is the one of the claimants on this land, his name is Barshatya. He vacillates between being lucid and being what's called the shota. That shota is, again, a very particular legal term. It doesn't mean what you and I think it means. Shota has very strict regulations that govern it. But in any event...
It's like crazy a little bit?
Again, it's not fair to translate as crazy because it has to do with someone who's...
Ambiguous.
It's subject, yeah, not objective.
There are four simoni shota. I mean, we'd have to spend a month on this. For example, he sleeps in a cemetery, or perhaps he takes money and he destroys it. There's something missing there. He's immature. But this person fluctuates back and forth. And those who work in mental, you know, with mental illness will know that that's common even in our time, as it was back in the time of the Gemara. So the question of the status of this Barshatya vis-a-vis the land, whether he has mukzakus, and mukzakus means that we know for sure, certainty, without any question, that at one point in time the karka was his, meaning the real estate was his. Again, it's not registered in the registry, but he has clear-cut testimony to the fact that it was his. Then anyone who claims he purchased the land would have to prove that that purchase was valid. Now, in order to prove that the purchase is valid, he would have to bring two witnesses who were there, who were present to witness this transaction, and could add to boot that Barshatya, at the time of the transaction, when he sold this land, he was lucid. He was what's called a pikeach, and therefore his transaction is valid. Mm. Now, the case that we're dealing with in this particular sugya is called treu trei, which literally translates as two against two. There were four eidim, and two of them testified X, and two of them contradicted and said not X. So we have two eidim that validate the sale by testifying that we were there and we know that Barshatya was perfectly lucid at the time that he sold the land. We have another two eidim who claimed that they were at the scene of the crime, at the scene of the transaction. We know that Barshatya was a shota at the time of the sale. The sale, therefore, is invalid. Mm-hmm. So what do we do in this case? So the Gemara has a very complicated answer to this question. The Gemara says that we can allow Barshatya to remain the owner of the land if he has what's called a chazakah. That means if we can establish that at one moment in time he was the true, certain, unquestionable owner of this real estate. Now that would be great if he had two witnesses who could testify that this piece of real estate once belonged to his father, who's no longer alive, and he inherited it. Then for sure he has a chazak. We know certainly...
Because it was like the last absolute point in time that we know for
at
sure.
At one point in time, whatever that point in time is, but it's before this transaction, he was definitely the owner of the field. Therefore, if this transaction is a suffix, it's in doubt, because as we said before, we got two witnesses against two witnesses, and that creates a stalemate. Then we have to allow Barshatya to continue in the original status quo of his chazakah. That's because he has two witnesses to testify that this land belonged to his father and he inherited it. If, in the absence of those two witnesses, Barshatya has no way of claiming ownership on the field other than the fact that he bought the field, that's not good enough. That's not going to cut the mustard. What do you mean you bought the field? Well, just like you're claiming that the transaction now when you sold the field is invalid because you have two eidim, so then maybe when you purchased the field that purchase was invalid. To the same extent, you're a shota now when you sold it, you might have been, 50% chance, a shota when you purchased the land. So basically, in such a case where Barshatya could not establish that he was at one time the owner of the field, that's called marakama, because two witnesses testify that his father owned the field, in the absence of such proof, Barshatya's chazakah is not a chazakah. Because just like he sold the field in an invalid transaction, maybe he purchased the field in an invalid sense. Now, if the original owner who sold the field to Barshatya could come into Beis Din, if we would only be able to find him on the face of the earth, he would have a great claim to the karka, because he's the marakama. We know that he once owned the field. But in the absence of such a claimant, of such a plaintiff, he's not available for questioning, then the one who purchased the field from Barshatya, he becomes what we call, the muhzak. Why? Not because we know for sure that he purchased the field with a valid transaction. We can't establish that. We got a trade. We have a stalemate between two eidim contradicting each other, two pairs of eidim. But simply because he's down in the land. That's why in your case, Chaim, where you got someone up there in Hawaii, you know, who's tending to your field, let's say, or whatever he's doing, in a halachic context, back at the time of the Talmud, when we didn't have land registry, you better be very careful.
Right.
Because if he turns against you, you know, you have to make sure he's an honest guy. If he turns against you, and one day he comes forward and claims that he purchased the field from you, he might be believed. Now that depends on another sugya, which is the third perek in Bava Basra. We're learning now Ksubas, but in the third perek of Bava Basra, there's something called Cheskas Gimel Shonen, which means that if a squatter lives on the land for 3 years, and during that period of time no one protested, then he could claim and be believed that he purchased the field. So this becomes.
I think there is some type of Hawaii law like that.
Yeah.
I've heard.
Maybe they got it from us. I don't know.
I think they got the whole name of the islands from us. Hawaii, Havaya.
Oh, that's cool. You got to be careful when you say Hawaii now. You know, you may be saying God's name. You know, can't say Hawaii in a bathroom.
You know, wow.
You know the joke about the couple from. Can I insert a joke here?
Yeah, why not?
A couple from.
It's almost Purim.
An old couple. The wife's always complaining. The husband says, "What can I do to make you happy?" She says, "To make me happy, you can take me to Hawaii." He says, "Fine, I'll take you to Hawaii, but it's not pronounced Hawaii. It's pronounced Havaya." Excuse me. And she says, "You're wrong, but just take me." So he's calling to the ticket agent. She says, "Listen, my wife wants to book a ticket to Havaya," and she screams in the background, "It's pronounced Hawaii." So anyway, they fly, and the whole time they're debating on the plane, Stuart, get off the plane, they see a man in the hula skirt. And the husband says, "Excuse me, can you settle an argument I'm having with my wife?" is the name of this place Hawaii or Hawaii? And he says, it's Hawaii. And the husband says, thank you. And he turns to his wife and he says, see? And he turns to his wife and says, see? And he turns to the man and he says, thank you. And he says, you're welcome.
You're welcome. I like it. Okay, Rabbi, so let's make a little progress. Okay. Now, Chaim, I don't know, do you want the text in front of you, or you want to more listen just
there's
to...
There's an English version. Is there a Steinsitz?
There is a... Well, Steinsitz we don't have, as far as I know, but we do have an art scroll.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
You know where it is? I'll go...
You
want
to get it, Aaron? It's on the back, is this the back the wall.
Is that why you're here? This is not a family? No. Is it related to Purim, or...?
No, we meet every Wednesday night, right here, same times. Again, three of our regulars are in Hawaii. No, not really, but they're abroad. And one of them is on a flight to Johannesburg. That's Brian Levine. One of them is in the Alps somewhere. That's Daniel Pfeffer. And one of them is somehow busy tonight. You know, Rabbi Goldschneider, he didn't tell me exactly what he's doing, but he said he had a very important commitment tonight. So Chaim, it's good that you joined us, because, you know, we need everybody that we can get here. We're missing three regulars. Okay, so Blinetter, we're going to get you an art scroll so you can follow this inside. What I'd like to do is give an introduction to the next piece of Gemara that we want to study. There are two concepts in the laws of testimony which are very similar but yet fundamentally different. One is called Hazama, which means that the second pair of Edom turn to the first pair of Edom. They say, you couldn't have seen that crime as you claim you did because you were with us at that time in a different part of the world. Okay, that's called Hazama. Now, in the case of Hazama, one thing is crystal clear, and that is that the second pair of Edom are actually attacking the first pair of Edom. I don't mean physically, but as a result of the second pair of Edom, the Hazama, what's going to happen to the first pair of Edom?
Coming belly.
Not only that, they're going to be punished.
Right.
They're going to be punished for plagiarizing their testimony. That's called Vasisim Lo Kasha Zoma. Now, because of that structure in which the second pair of Edom are attacking the first pair of Edom, and they are testifying that there was a false testimony here, therefore, the testimony of the second pair of Edom would only be valid if the first pair of Edom were in the court at the time of their testimony. That's called Bifanov. And that's a technical rule. We'll call it what sport is it? In basketball, is it technical foul, or is that football? Where's that phrase that I remember from my childhood? A technical foul.
Basketball.
Okay, so basketball is something called a technical foul. Okay. Doesn't matter whether you know this or not. What I mean by technical is that there's certain rules and regulations that govern the courts, and every society has its own system, its own regulations. The Torah system is that whenever you're testifying against a baldin, against a person, the baldin has to be there, you know, the victim has to be there at the time of your testimony. And therefore, since Hazama is a classical case of a testimony against somebody, that somebody, which means the first pair of Edom, have to be there at the time of the Hazon. Okay then? And that's Omar Rabbi Avo, Ein Mazimin Es Ha'edim El Bifnehem. You have that?
How far down?
Okay, how far down is it? Okay, if you... Yeah, okay.
Well, less than half.
Let's see.
You've got it done, isn't it?
Here, if I point to it, does that help you at all?
Absolutely. Okay.
Omer Yabevo?
Okay, yeah.
It's not across from any special toasts here, so I can't...
First line's up.
Okay, so, Ein Mazimin Es Ha'edim Ela Bifneihem. And why is that? Because the first pair of Edom is going to suffer either mama and they'll have to pay, or they might be put to death. Right? It depends what the testimony was. However, says Rabbi Avo, Umakrishim Es Ha'edim Shelo Bifneihem. If the second pair of Edom have nothing to say about the first pair of Edom, but they're only contradicting the testimony of the first pair of Edom, not the ability of the first pair of Edom to testify. Mm. They're not saying Yimonu Ayisim, but they're saying that we were there at the time, and we know that this person, Mr. Lova, did not borrow the money from Mr. Malva the way you claim. Mm. So in effect, they're not contradicting the Edom, right, as we call Gavra, the personality of the Eidim, but rather their testimony is to contradict the content or the substance of the Eidus. Mm. And therefore, Makhishim as Eidim Shalom Bifnehem, since they're not attacking the first pair of Eidim, the first pair of Eidim are not on trial, because they will not be put to death or suffer any other penalty or punishment as a result of Hakhasha. Therefore, Hakhasha doesn't require that technical requirement that we mentioned before, that the Mukhashim, that the first pair of Eidim, have to be present in Bezdin.
Is that why we call it Trey Utrey and not Eidim Zomim? Is that
correct? Okay. And that's called Trey Utrey. So whenever you hear the term Trey Utrey, two against two, it means Hakhasha. There's a contradiction about whether the Reuven, in fact, borrowed money from Shimon or didn't borrow from money from Shimon. And by the way, this concept of trade could apply even in a capital case. For example, the first pair of Eidim said that Reuven killed Shimon. The second pair of Eidim denied it, and they said that Reuven did not kill Shimon. That's also called trade. Mm. And the first pair of Eidim do not have to be present in the courtroom when the second pair of Eidim testified that Reuven did not kill Shimon. But now, here's the following question that Rabbi Yavo wants to address. Supposing the second pair of Eidim testified imanu ha'isim against the first pair of Eidim. That's called what? Hazama, right? You were with us, you couldn't have been at the crime. But the first pair of Eidim were not there at the time of that testimony. So for sure, it doesn't operate as hazama. And there's no question about it that the first two Eidim will not be punished. Because again, that's the technical requirement that Hazama requires Bifneim. However, can we convert the Hazama into at least a Hakhasha? Because since the second pair of Eidim is saying that you weren't there at the time that you claim you were there to witness the crime, or witness the transaction, therefore your Eidus is invalid. So although as an attack against the personality of the Eidim, Hazama, that requires Bifnehem, and that requirement was not fulfilled, so a technical foul that disqualifies Hazama. But within Hazama, we also have Hakhasha, as far as the Eidus itself. In other words, is the first testimony valid or not valid? According to the second pair of Eidim, it's not valid. So let's just read the text. The Gemara says, "Va'azama shalom b'fneihem." If there was a hazama and the first pair of Eidim were not present in the courtroom, here, take this, Aaron.
Thank you.
Is then nehi, even though hazama lo havi, it cannot live up to the standards requirements of hazama, but hakhasha mi havi. But nevertheless, it does serve as hakhasha. It's kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase Yesh b'chal masai imona, that every 200 has 100 within it. So every time there's hazama, there's really two things going on over here. Number one, the mazimim are claiming that the first pair of Eidim perjured themselves, and therefore they have to suffer, you know, the punishment of hazama, v'sisim l'kashazama, etc., etc. And number two, they're also at the same time invalidating the testimony of the first pair of Eidim. Says Rabbi Avo, even if there's a technical that prevents, that's barrier, prevents us from applying the laws of Hazama in order to attack the first pair of Eidim, but at least we can apply the laws of Hakhasha because the second pair of Eidim are invalidating the testimony of the first pair of Eidim. So it becomes Hakhasha.
Could you clarify what Hakhasha is?
Hakhasha means a contradiction in the testimony without impinging or without attacking the first pair of Eidim and their status.
It's like introducing a chashash into that's the sharash?
Hakhasha means to contradict lehakhish. Oh, okay. That is literally translated into English, it would be a denial. Hakhasha is a denial, mm-hmm. Meaning I deny your testimony.
And it's not true.
That's called trey. Every akhosh is the same as trey by definition.
But
what's lacking in akhosh when we use that term is hazama. They didn't use the magical formula called imanu ha'isim. You were with us in a different place at that time. Yeah.
But if we group the two together like this, the akhosh and the hazama, and say that like every hazama comes with a akhosh,
right?
Then the order is really important because if you say the Hakhasha goes into effect first, then you're basically disqualifying your testimony completely, and then there's no hazama to be done. There's,
right, right. We're going to first, I guess your point is, first we're going to analyze the second edus from the perspective of hazama. If that fails, then it becomes hakhosh.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, the chiddush of Rabbi Avoh, his insight is the following, if we want to just summarize it, that even though the Eidus was, in a technical sense, on the surface level, was Hazama, but nevertheless we can split this Eidus into two. We can say it's Hazama, but it's also Hakhosha. Right? Because in Hakhosha, they are invalidating the first testimony, and that makes it into Hakhosha. So as far as the level of Hazam is concerned, it's not valid, as we called it a technical foul, but at least as a Hakhosha, it can be valid, because the precondition of Bifnehem, that has to be in the presence of the Edim, that is a precondition in Hazama, but that requirement is completely dropped with regard to Hakhosha. So even though the Edus cannot function and serve as Hazama, but let it function as Hakhosha, which means we're left with Treyu Trey. Now, I would like to present to you a very fascinating thesis of Rabbi Kivager. Mm. Rabbi Kivager is bothered by the following question. When Rav Ashi, before Rabbi Avoh, wanted to establish that in a case of Treyu Trey, we leave it wherever it is, in the Yad of the Muchzok, he quoted this case of Bar Shatya as a proof. Why did Rav Ashi need a proof? I mean, what could we have even imagined as an alternative? If you have a Treyu Trey situation, you don't know which pair of Eidim is telling the truth, then throw the case out of court and leave the object or the property wherever it is. What was the point, asks Rabbi Kivager, of proving from Bar Shatya that the halacha is that way? That's obvious. There's no chiddush over here. There's no great insight that you need to evoke any proofs. Then Rabbi Kivager suggests a possible answer to his question, that from Bar Shatya, they wanted to prove that not only does Beis Din have a non-involvement policy with regard to Treyu Trey, but more than that, whoever grabs onto the karka is the one who owns it. And Rabbi Kivager says that's impossible, because in the case of karka, it always goes back to the Marukama. If it would have been a movable object, like let's say, for example, we had Treyu Trey on whether I sold you a diamond ring, then it would make sense that if you grabbed it out of my hand, well, Beis Din again has a non-involvement policy. But in the case of karka, that doesn't work. So Rabbi Kivager comes up with the following fascinating conclusion. He says that if not for Bar Shatya and that old story, we would have assumed Yachloku, that we split the land in half. We have two Eidim this way, two Eidim that way. We don't know how the halacha should go.
Like the talus, like that.
Oh, excellent. The case at the beginning of Mitzvah, two people holding on to a talus. Each one claims, I found it and I picked it up. So the Mishnah Paskin is that we split the talus, which, by the way, doesn't mean literally we split the talus. Half the talus is worth nothing. But we sell the talus and split its value. Fine. So Kivager says the following. Why don't we say Yachloku in this case? And he says that there are two ways of understanding the mechanics of Treyu Trey. Listen carefully. One way is called Treyu Trey Sfeika Derabbanan. I'll explain what that means. In Treyu Trey Sfeika Derabbanan, what happens is that, just one second, that in every case of Treyu Trey, we simply don't know what to do. And basically what we have is each party, each litigant, has two Eidim to support his claim. That's called Treyu Trey Sfeika Derabbanan. And in that case, since each party has a chazak, has a support, he has two aidim to support his claim, then we're going to tip the scale in this case in favor of the muhsak. Who's ever actually in possession, he's got two aidim to support his possession. That's called trei trei sveika d'rabban. But there's another way of defining trei trei. That's called sveika d'oraisa. And trei trei sveika d'oraisa means that no matter what evidence you have, all that evidence is completely null and void. Why? Because any evidence you induce in this case is going to be contradicted by one of the two pairs of Aden. And in that case, the Chazok is completely meaningless. So that's the Chiddush here of Bar Shatya, that if all things are equal, they're going to allow the Karka to remain in the possession of Bar Shatya. Let's say he can prove that he inherited this Karka 50 years ago from his late father. We're going to allow Bar Shatya to establish his ownership on the karka based on that chazok, despite the fact that there are two eidim that testify that he sold the karka, I mean he was lucid at the time of the sale. And the reason for that is because we're going to say trei trei sveika d'rabbanan, meaning we're going to say that in trei trei we're going to throw out all the eidim, so to speak. No one has any proof here, because if two pairs of eidim are fighting it out, we have to throw them all out of court. We're left with, you know, status quo. What was the status quo before these two pairs of Adam came in? And that's called Chazaka. But if we would apply the other logic of trei trei as a sveika d'oraisa, which means that each party here has the support of two Adam, we're not going to throw out both pairs of Adam. Then Chazaka becomes meaningless, and in a meaningless case of Chazaka, we're going to apply the principle of Yachloku and split it down the middle. So that's why the Gemara quotes this whole story of Ravashi with the Bar Shatya to prove that we don't say Yachloku. We're not going to apply the principle of Trei Trei Sveika D'oraisa, but rather we're going to apply the Halach of Chazaka, because Bar Shatya has two Adim to support his Chazaka.
Why? Is that because Chazaka...
Was that too complicated? Again, that was... This is Rabbi Kivega, you know, one of the geniuses of all time, but...
Is that because Chazaka is Derabana?
What do you say?
Is that because Chazaka is also Derabana?
No. Chazaka is Doraisa, but the question is, when Chazaka is up against two witnesses, then that Chazaka is meaningless. Because the principle in Halacha is trei kemeah. You know, two witnesses are like 100 witnesses, or like 1,000,000 witnesses. So Chazaka is a very nice... Hachras asafik, meaning if we don't know what to do, we'll fall back on chazaka, status quo. But when that chazaka is contradicted by two witnesses, which is like 100 witnesses or 1,000,000 witnesses, then the chazaka falls apart. It becomes irrelevant. But it all depends how I view trei trei. If I view trei trei as if both pairs of Adam are valid, you know, which is what you'd call, you know, Zeno's paradox. You know, how can they both be valid? And when they contradict each other, we know that one pair is lying, but it doesn't matter. Since we cannot determine which pair of Adam is lying, then both Adam are considered as if they were telling the truth. And in that case, Chazaka becomes meaningless, because whoever is trying to get the possession out of someone who has a chazaka, what's he going to do? He's going to contradict the two Adam that support that chazaka? You know what I mean? Or whoever has a chazaka, he's going to prove based on his chazaka against the two Adim of the person who doesn't have a chazaka. In a word, Rabbi Kivega says that if trei trei is a sveika d'oraisa, and both pairs of Adim are valid, then chazaka becomes totally meaningless. The chiddush here of Bar Shatya is that trei trei is only a sveika d'rabbanan. Let me read to you the words of Rabbi Kivega. He says, "Ilu haya hasafik min haTorah." Is then min haTorah ein holchim achal chazaka betrei trei, because both contestants have the support of two edim. Is therefore haya adin yachloku. The chiddush then of Bar Shatya is that we're not going to apply the law of yachloku, because trei trei is a sveika d'rabbanan. All right, fine. Omar Mar, let's go on. Im yesh edim sheksav yodom huzeh. If the two witnesses who testified against this shtar, that the shtar is invalid because it was signed under duress, or it was signed when they were still minors, or it was signed by relatives, and the shtar itself against which they're testifying is a shtar makuya. Makuya means that we've already established the validity of that shtar as far as forgery is concerned. Right? Every shtar, every document is considered questionable. You know, we don't know if it's counterfeit, if the signatures are authentic or not authentic. Okay. Now, if we can establish that this document was signed and there's no forgery, it's authenticated, that's called kiyum shtaros, then the Eidim, when they come in and testify that the shtar is invalid because the witnesses were compelled to sign the shtar, etc., etc., then it's trade. You know, we have two against two. Now, the question is, how do we establish that this shtar is authentic? How are we to be mekayim the shtar? So we have two ways of being mekayim the shtar mentioned here. One is to bring in two witnesses who recognize these signatures, and they say those are authentic signatures. Okay, I can recognize this John Hancock, right? Mm-hmm. And the other method is to compare this shtar and its signatures to another document that's already been authenticated by the courts.
Similar to paintings, similar to...
What do you mean by paintings?
Like, if you want to know if it's a Van Gogh, so you compare it to another Van Gogh that you know is for sure a Van Gogh.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Okay, I didn't know that actually happens in the world of art. I guess when they question whether there's a forgery here in the art, and that signature is not really the signature of, I call him Van Gogh, you call him Van Gogh. It's the same guy, but... Okay. So now, notice that when the Gemara offers this possibility of authenticating the signatures of the shtar by comparing it to another shtar, the Gemara adds a condition. That other shtar has on it what's called a henpek. Mm. The closest thing in modern contemporary life to a henpek would be a notarized seal, or here in Israel they have what's called a red ribbon. Have you ever seen it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, if you notarize a contract here in Israel, and maybe in many European countries, I don't know, then the notary attaches to the document a red ribbon. You know, he has to push it in, it's all to do. Now, what that means is, basically, that let's say you have the same two signatures on two different documents. That doesn't prove a thing. Because it could be that both documents are a forgery. The only way I can finally be absolutely certain is if the courts questioned this shtar and they proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that the signatures are valid. And then they attach what's called a henpek to the shtar, you know, that red ribbon. Mm. Now I could use that shtar and compare it to another shtar, and if the signatures are perfectly mirror images one of the other, then we can validate the shtar. Okay, then? So the Gemara now, you know, really spells this out. Kara olav irur in, lo kara olav irur lo. This idea of comparing one shtar to another only applies when somebody questioned the validity of the shtar. Like, let's say, for example, the malve claims that he lent money to the Lova, here's my document. The Lova, on the other hand, said, no, it's a forgery. And Bezdin actually went through the entire procedure of validating the shtar by authenticating the signatures. And then they put what we call the henpek, which is an Aramaic word for the stamp of approval. But lo karav lo, but if you have just a shtar floating in space, you know, out there in the market, somebody has a shtar and has the same two edim, then to the same extent that we're worried about the validity of shtar A, we have to worry about the authenticity of shtar B. Shtar B doesn't help me. You can have 1,000 documents with the same two signatures, it doesn't prove a thing, because there may be one counterfeiter who's counterfeiting all these shtars. You follow my point?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the FBI now is thinking that all these bomb threat, you know, calls are coming from one person.
Mm.
All of the, you know, synagogues and JCCs all over the United States. Okay, I don't know. We'll see what they're able to prove and not. In a sense, if it's one person, I'll be relieved. Because once they get a hold of this guy, then maybe life for the Jews will be a little easier. In any event, Misayel Eilu Rav Yasi, this will support the position of Rav Asi, the Omer of Asi. We can only validate the signatures on the shtar and to determine that it's not counterfeit, Ella Mishtar, only from comparing it to another Shtar, Shekara Olav Irur, that there was a question about the validity of that second Shtar, Vahuksak the Bezdin, and as a result of the entire procedure and the investigation of Bezdin, they added a henpeg to the Shtar. But if you have more than one star with the same two signatures, but neither of the two stars have that henpeg on it, then comparing the signatures is meaningless, because maybe, as we said before, there was a counterfeit on both stars. So that's the opinion of Rav Asi.
It sounds like here that the henpeg is more than just a notary, because it's because now anyone can take a document and have it notarized.
Right.
It's like here it has to be like
right. It's a bad example. I meant to say was that if, let's say, the notary has a certain status in the government or in the law recognized, then what he does is he attaches something to the shtar. That's all I meant. That when Bezdin wants to validate the shtar so that nobody will ever question its, you know, the authenticity of its signatures, they add a henpeg. You know, that's all I meant to say. You're right. It's not a fair analogy.
It's more than that. It's like a real investigation. It's a real...
Correct. Bezdin has to go through an entire investigation. They'll subpoena the two aiden who are signed on the shtar to come forward and recognize their own signatures.
Wow.
Then and only then they'll add a henpeg. But now that they add the henpeg, that shtar becomes a very valid tool, because we can compare those signatures in the shtar that has a kiyum, has a henpeg, to a shtar that doesn't have a henpeg, and we can add a henpeg to any shtar that has the same identical two signatures.
Nice.
Again, in the world of computers, I don't know. You know, it could be that it's going to be quite challenging to compare virtual signatures, because I don't know that you can't, you know, well, I guess if there are codes or whatever, maybe that would prove it, but truth is, even with regard to real signatures, I'm not sure if the fact that, in other words, the premise of the Gemara is that it's virtually impossible to imitate someone's signature in a perfect way. You can counterfeit it, you can forge it, but not a perfect forgery. So when we have the two stars in front of us, we have the ability, again, we'll call it 99%, but with almost absolute certainty, to validate our premise that these signatures are the same signatures. Otherwise, this whole concept of henpeg would not help us to be mekayem another star. Okay. Ami Naradoi. Now, this is fascinating. Naradoi is going to claim that there are scenarios in which we can simply compare two shtaros in order to create a kiyum and validate the signatures, even though there's no henpeg on either of the two shtaros. In other words, Naradoi is going to look for scenarios in which we can have a substitute henpeg, so to speak, another method of validating the shtar. Ami Naradoi, ein mekayim es hashtar, you cannot validate a shtar by comparing it to another shtar that doesn't have a henpeg in it, Ella, except for the following two cases. Number one, mishtei suvos. Okay, we'll explain that in just a minute. Oh, mishtei sados, v'husha achlum baleem shalosh shanim b'shofi. Now, you remember I said to you before that if somebody is squatting on land for 3 years and he's enjoying the benefits of the produce of the land, and he's plowing and planting and harvesting and he's marketing all his produce for 3 years consecutively and nobody says a word, that establishes that his claim that he bought the field is a true claim. Okay, that's called Cheskes Gimel Shanim. Now, supposing after this period of 3 years, he puts the shtar in, in a vault or something, okay? Now, in this case, his shtar never got to Bezdin. They never laid eyes on it, so certainly it doesn't have a henpeg on it. Mm-hmm. But there's no question in anyone's mind that the shtar is valid. Why? Because he has a Cheskes Gimel Shanim, and that proves that he bought the field, and therefore the shtar is no doubt a valid, authentic shtar.
Interesting.
So in this case, because he had 3 years of chazaka, his shtar that testifies to the fact that he bought the field is a valid and clear, authentic shtar without any counterfeit, even without a henpeg.
Well, all it does is prove the shtar in terms of the result of the shtar, and the fact that he owns it. It has nothing to do with the signatures. The signatures.
Well, no. What we're saying is the following: how did he purchase this field? So he says he purchased the field with a shtar. The shtar is what's called the shtar kinyan, and it clinches the transaction. You might say, well, he's lying through his teeth. There are two signatures that testify that he bought the field. That was a forgery. He forged their signatures. No, we're not going to say that. We have proof that he didn't forge their signatures. That this indeed was the shtar that he used to clinch this transaction. How do I prove that? From the fact that he's been living on the land for 3 years, nobody bothered him, nobody raised a voice of protest. That proves that he's the valid, true owner of the field.
That's like a lack of proof is proof. It's like it could be that everyone just died.
Okay, so for that we'd have to learn the third parak of Bava Basra. Okay. And there are many, many conditions that have to be met. You know, we have to assume that the one who's claiming that he didn't sell the field was there and somewhere in the vicinity. Mm. If he was in a different country, then the chazok is not valid. There are zillions of conditions, and for that you have to learn the third parak of Bava Basra. Okay, but let's assume that all the conditions were met. He has an absolute chazak that proves that he in fact bought the field. Therefore, the shtar of this transaction, the document of sale, is a valid document of sale. And the signatures are authentic. They're not forged. Now the shtar has the same status, says Naradoy, as a shtar sheyesh bo henpik. Even though in the case of a shtar sheyesh bo henpik, Beis Din investigated the signatures, and then they added the henpik to the shtar. This case is a case of a shtar that Beis Din never even laid eyes on. But it doesn't matter. Because as long as we have proof positive that the shtar is authentic, that's as good as a henpik. Even if Beis Din never laid eyes on the shtar. That's the second case. The first case is shteik subos. Now what's this case of shteik subos? Okay? You and I know that when a man marries a woman, he writes a ksuba. The ksuba is handed over to the woman, and she uses that ksuba to prove that in event that he dies or he divorces, so she can collect whatever is written in the ksuba. So in the case of a first marriage, it's 200 zuz. In the case of a second marriage, 100 zuz, etc., etc. There's nitzay belug, nitzay tzom barzel, the whole nine yards, which is basically the other half of this masef that we didn't get to yet. What's exactly written in the ksuba? Oh. Now, we assume that if a woman is living with her husband for such and such a period of time, that there must have been a ksuba. In other words, in the case of a ksuba, we have no reason to suspect that there was any forgery in the ksuba. I'll read to you what he says here. He says, "Afal gavdi ein henpek baksuba." There's no actual henpek. Means Beis Din never laid eyes on this ksuba. Hare mimashe he tachas baila. The very fact that we know that she's married to him, mahavehol chacha. That serves as a proof. Shaksuba ein mezuyefes. That this ksuba is not a forgery. Okay then. So that means that if, let's say, another woman has a ksuba, right? And there's reason to wonder, and the Baal says that ksuba is a forgery. We can compare the signature on that ksuba with the other ksuba of a woman who's been living with her husband for such a long time, and we have every reason to prove and assume that ksuba is valid.
Where's the second ksuba from?
Say it again?
Where's the second ksuba from?
So I'm just saying, if let's say we have two married couples, right? Mm-hmm. We'll call one Rachel and one is Leah. So if Rachel has been living with her husband for the last 20 years, when she comes to collect her ksuba, we believe that ksuba is authentic. There's no forgery of the signatures. Now, that was Rachel, right? Now, let's say Leah produces her shtar ksuba to collect from her husband, and there's some issue about the validity of that shtar. Let's say, for example, the Baal claims that this was a forgery. In such a case, we can compare the signature, if it's the same two signators? Is there such a word in English? If it's the same two signators, if not, I invented that word, on both ksuvas, that of Rachel and that of Leah, then if Leah's husband claims, well, this is a forgery, then we can disprove his claim by comparing the signatures on Leah's ksuba to that of Rachel's ksuba. Yeah. Because since Rachel's ksuba had no question about it, there was no one who raised an eyebrow, and she was living with her husband for all these years, that's like a ksuba that has a hen fake, and therefore if we compare the signatures and they match up, that's enough to validate the shtar. Omar Rav Simi Barashi. Rav Simi Barashi says, wait a minute. Did I skip anything?
No, I have a question. Does that mean we're limiting it that you can only compare ketubas to ketubas? I don't think so.
I think the Gemara is just giving a classical case. So anyway, we have 2 minutes till Meirev. Thank you, Chaim. And what I want to do is, in those 2 minutes, just try to get to the punchline here. So I'm going to read it really quickly, and hopefully I'll explain it. Omar Rav Simi Barashi, ubi yotze mitachas yad acher. The only way we can use that other shtar, which doesn't have a henpeg of it, as a way to validate the shtar, is if somebody else has the shtar. But if he himself produces the shtar, and he says, here, look, I have two shtaros, that doesn't prove a thing. So the Gemara asks, Maishno tachas yad atzmo delo. Why are you excluding a comparison between the two shtaros if he's holding on to both shtaros? Dilma ziyufe mizayef. Because the same, you know, he created the same counterfeit for both shtaros, right? So he says, mitachas yad acher nami, even in the case where somebody else produces that shtar, we should also be afraid that maybe he got hold of the shtar, you know, he took a picture of the shtar, and he was able to counterfeit the signatures. Dilma ozal, v'chaza, he went and he saw the shtar in the hands of someone else, the Asa Viziyev, and then he came and he counterfeited. Gemara says, Kuli hai lo motzi mecham. We don't have to be worried for such a thing, that the man got a hold of another shtar somewhere on the face of the earth with the same two signatures or whatever, and he forged, he memorized, and he was able to create another shtar with the same two signatures. Okay then? Here's where we're going to end. If there are any questions, you know, we have another minute till Meir, if you can ask the question. Can I borrow? You have a pencil?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I just want to make a note as to where we get up to.
I didn't see the word henpeck here. Is that...
Henpeck is in Rashi.
Oh, it's in Rashi. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I just added that information in order to help clarify. But
I was just
when there was a shtar, Yotzel of Iru, and Besman established the shtar, what they do is they put a henpeck on the shtar.